Today I'm talking with Dr. Joe Francis, someone whose name should be familiar to many Answers subscribers. Dr. Francis has written many articles for Answers magazine, and he's probably reviewed even more for scientific accuracy. After earning his PhD from Wayne State University, Dr. Francis served 4 years as a postdoctoral fellow and 1 year as a research scientist at the University of Michigan, and then taught biology for 10 years at Cedarville University before joining the faculty of the Master's College in 2002. Today, Dr. Francis is chairperson of the Department of Biological and Physical Sciences and Department of Mathematics, and also professor of biological sciences at the Master's College. Dr. Francis is a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and has published numerous scientific articles in medical and biological journals. His research interests include microscopy, cellular immunology, invertebrate biology, and microbiology. Dr. Francis, welcome.
Great, thank you.
I'd like to start off with just a little bit about your personal background. What was it that got you into creation research?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's one of those questions that makes you think about your past, and because my interest would go way back. And so it's when you live on this earth for a certain period of time, you start losing your memory. And so, but my earliest recollection is just being interested in science. And because of that, I got interested in reading about how Christians do science. And what's even more interesting is I went to a grew up in a very conservative Baptist home. My grandfather was a preacher and used the Scofield Bible. And I didn't realize until many, many years later that the Scofield Bible taught what we call old earth creationism. But, you know, I don't remember him ever preaching on that, so I wasn't really influenced by it. And so when I got interested in science as a teenager, about the time I went to college, I started reading the material from Institute of Creation Research, which started publishing, putting out publications in the 1970s. And I thought, this is interesting. These are scientists, and that's what I want to do. And these are scientists who are Christians, and they want to do science, but they also see how the Bible intersects with their science. And not only that, but science raises questions about where we came from and the whole evolution and creation issue and debate. And I thought, this is fascinating. This is fascinating to read something by someone who has a common interest to mine. And so by reading that, I really didn't even read some of the classic books by Henry Morse at that time. I just read a lot of the mailing publications, and I thought, this makes logical sense. The Bible talks about 6 days of creation, and that is very interesting with respect and how we think about things like science. And I thought, wow, this is logical, and it makes sense, and it's consistent with the Bible. And that's how I got into creationism, and I really didn't know much about other creationist views. I really wasn't taught evolution that much in the schools at that time. I think in the 1960s and 70s, some teachers were just afraid of the subject. And so I was really influenced heavily by some of those early publications.
Okay. And then you went on into research. Now you're doing a lot of research. You're also teaching. Would you say you have a preference? Would you rather be a teacher or a researcher?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think as I get into my career more and more, I find, when you first start in science, you like it all. I think it's like a candy store, and you want to do this and do that. As I go on, I think what's most enjoyable to me is pondering problems and then writing about them. But at the same time, it's just as fun to communicate that to others, and that's where teaching becomes enjoyable. So I like thinking, researching, writing, communicating the best I can what I think is a Christian worldview and the creation part of it. And then that just seems to flow naturally into the classroom, and it makes the classroom more enjoyable to be able to share what you're learning and thinking about and pondering with your students. And so I kind of like it all, but I do like the writing and research part.
And I do want to get into some of that research in a little bit. Before we do, the one question that just wants to jump out, I guess, is how your interaction with other scientists who do not share your creationist views goes. I mean, do you face discrimination because of your creationist views, or Do you find that you actually can get a lot of dialogue with people who are follow an evolutionary worldview?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been teaching at Christian colleges for 23 years, and so I mostly intersect with those who believe the way I do. I've had some collaborations with non-believers, and that's kind of interesting. In some of those cases where we did science, the philosophy of science, whether creation or evolution, didn't really enter into what our science was. And so I could do science without being involved in that debates about the philosophy. However, a few years ago, some atheists were interested in our creation symposium that we hold every year at the Master's College. And I developed a dialogue with them because they were interested in what we were doing and wondered how we could really do science as creationists and Christians. And what was fascinating about that is we ended up developing a dialogue with them that led to a debate that we held at the college. But we spent a year actually working on relationships and even developing friendships. And through that time, there were some heated times where they were very dismissive of the fact that Christianity and science could go together, and some were condescending. But for the most part, most of them were very curious. They were just curious that someone could believe in the Bible and do science. And of course, if you reminded them about the history of science and how much Christianity was involved, there was some interest in that also. So that ended up being a positive experience. And so I haven't worked in the public workplace enough to know about discrimination. I did do all my schooling in public school and a postdoctoral fellowship in public schools, and I didn't really hide my beliefs, but at the same time, people did recognize that, oh, you're not here during parts of the week, and you're not here on Sundays. And I remember one person saying, you're going to a Bible study, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And I never really was shunned because of it overtly. There may have been some people who avoided me. But I think for the most part, and I think this is probably true for many others, if you do your work and you do good work, the issue may rarely come up, even though there are cases of discrimination.
Okay. What active research are you doing in creation now?
Yeah, I started out as a cell biologist doing work on the human immune system. That was my original work many, many years ago. And what I enjoyed about it is just finding out about how white blood cells function. And my philosophy is any research we do is creation research because it all involves God's creation. Over time, though, as I taught at Christian colleges and saw the importance of basing my teaching in science in a Christian worldview, I started thinking about research projects that relate to that. And for instance, I've been doing some modeling, what we call creation modeling, in the area of microbiology. As I might have stated earlier, microbiology is the study of microorganisms like viruses and bacteria that just cause a lot of problems in human medicine. And they look designed. These pathogenic bacteria and viruses, they have designs, and those designs, many of them, are involved in making us ill. And so for a creationist, we believe that God created everything in the beginning, and those designs are consistent with what he created in the beginning. And so how do we justify, how do we explain what appears to be this evil creation in the beginning of his creation? So I developed some ideas about well, maybe we're looking at this in the wrong way. Maybe these creatures who have these evil designs, those designs were actually used for something good because he said everything was good. And that's what's so liberating about the strict creationist view, is we really believe that there was a change in nature, that before the fall, nature was a certain way. It was very good and perfect. Probably doesn't mean you couldn't scrape your knee a bit, that sort of thing. But after the fall, there was a big change. And so that principle of the fall, the literal fall, guides all of my research, because now I have a basis for saying, looking for the good function of what appears to be designed evil in nature, and we're finding it. In creationism, we're finding things that we thought were toxic to have good functions. And that's exciting because creationists can look at things a different way, in a more holistic way, and contribute to science, and contribute to an area of science that other people are not thinking about.
Where do you see creation research in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at the creationist movement, which influenced me very positively in the 1970s, that's where we go back to the beginning of the active creationist movement in the United States. It influenced me positively because I saw scientists doing Christians who were doing science. At the same time, a lot of the focus of those ministries became anti-evolution, and that was important too, to show the distinction between evolution and creation. However, I think a lot of the money and the focus was on apologetics and showing the shortcomings of evolution. Pure creation research has been just kind of played second fiddle, but I'm encouraged by a lot of young creationists coming up. We have some societies now, the Creation Biology Society and the Creation Geology Society and the CRS group and others who have their sole focus or part of their focus to generate research. And that's very encouraging. I think I'm very encouraged because we're moving forward more than we have, but it's slow. But what's encouraging is I see young PhDs and scientists with master's degrees coming up and getting excited about doing research. I think it'll remain slow, though, because in our Christian institutions, we really don't have fundraising going on for research. It's hard for me to compete with scientists who are getting funds from the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health to do creation research, because they probably won't fund it, although we have creationists getting funding in that way too. So I think it's going to continue to be slow unless we figure out how to get more funding. At the same time, we can still be creative with what we have, and some of the largest discoveries in science were based on simple models and even things that didn't cost very much. So I'm encouraged that it's moving forward. I would love to be a voice for it moving forward into a greater degree, and I'd love to see people get involved in helping funding it. But it's not an easy thing, because where we do research, creation research, is at schools, and some schools might hold different views on things, or some church denominations might hold different views. So it's not easy to actually get the funding for it. But again, I'm encouraged that we find Christian young people are coming up saying that they want to do more of it.
Well, two questions about supporting research. One of their easy, readily established ways that the average person can support creation research by funding, in small dollar amounts. And secondly, what other ways can average people support the work of creation scientists?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the Creation Biology Society, the CR, Creation Research Society, the Creation Geology Society are all established as incorporated nonprofit groups, and donations can be made. Here at the Master's College, we have received a donation for research in the last few years. It's rare, but it was very welcome. So if someone was aligned with a certain Christian school and their doctrinal position, they were happy with it, that would be a place is to call their science department and see if they do research. And how do you support it in other ways? I think other ways would be to have creationists speak in your church. That way ideas get out there and discussions begin and other people get alerted to it. So again, it's another way to get the word out for funding and support, and that is have these discussions in churches, have the educational focus. There's a lot of creationists who are very good educators, and they can be supported that way. But I think the biggest way that I see that research moves forward is that people actually talk about it, that we go into classrooms, we go into groups. I give my students research projects in the classroom. I feel that just teaching them in a one-way mode is not the best way for them to learn. And so I actually put them in groups and make them do research projects. And they're hard and they come kicking and screaming. But after the end of it, they have a product that they've thought through. They've come up with ideas. So I think the way to support it is to get people working on it, to get people together, to especially in education, to bring it into our different educational institutions and have people work together on problems. Even at a weekend seminar, say, we're going to give you some presentations, but then let's break up in groups and talk about how we would solve this problem. God has given us an amazing human mind and created us as problem solvers in the beginning. And so if we can foster more of that, I think it'll move forward better.
Yeah, what are some of those research projects you mentioned that you've gotten students involved in? You've got some patents, right, or pending patents on some research you've done and so on?
Yeah, I do research with bacteria, with some insects, and with white blood cells, the immune system, using invertebrate models like earthworms and things like that. Yeah, a few years ago, we were working with a bacterium that only grows on salt. And on Earth, we find bacteria in extreme places. We find bacteria growing in hot springs. We find bacteria that can basically just grow on solid salt. We find bacteria growing in acid. And what's really exciting about that is it's a part of observing the result of God's command when he basically exclaimed that living things should fill the earth. Well, that's what we find. We find them all over the earth, even in these strange places. So we brought this salt-loving bacteria into the laboratory. It's a bacteria that's being used more in high school and colleges because the salt that you grow this bacteria on, nothing else can grow on in our local environment. So one of the problems of looking at bacteria in the laboratory is most bacteria like to grow on sugars, and so do fungus, and so do other bacteria. So how do you study a single bacteria when every time you open up the sample, it's contaminated? Well, these salt-loving bacteria will only grow basically on almost saturated salt solutions, and nothing else can grow. It's deadly to them. So we were looking at this bacteria, and we were experimenting with its sensitivity to things in the environment. We were kind of looking for some natural antibiotics to develop a teaching lab. And we were even looking at kitchen spices and things like that. And we were soaking these potential antibiotics into pieces of paper and putting the pieces of paper on agar and looking for the bacteria to grow. If there was something in the paper that would kill them, they wouldn't grow near the paper. And this is actually done in the clinical laboratories. We put antibiotics in little pieces of paper, put them on a plate, and see if the bacteria will grow around that piece of paper to determine its antibiotic sensitivity. Well, we were doing this, and we found out that the paper itself was stopping the bacteria from growing. And this was very curious. So we thought, is it cellulose in the paper? Did somebody put something in the paper? And make a long story short, we traced this paper that they put antibiotics in. We traced it all the way to a company in England. And every place that we asked about the paper, they said, well, we don't put anything in it. Try this company. We don't put anything in the paper. It's just paper. Try this company. We traced it all the way back to a company in England, and they finally told us, no, we don't put anything in the paper except a little hardening agent. So when we use a hole puncher to punch out the pieces, the little circles of paper, it's stiff. We thought, oh, you put a chemical on it. Well, it turned out that chemical was an antibiotic for this salt-loving bacteria that no one had discovered. And then we found out that this salt-loving bacteria contaminates processes that we use today that we use high salt in, like making leather. We use an ancient method today for making leather that we've used for centuries, and that is to take a hide off an animal and throw it in the salt water. Well, that salt water, that brine, often gets these halo bacteria, they're called, in there and in the brine, and it actually will end up just making the leather orange and unusable. And there's some food products, the same thing happens. So we were able to write a patent about how this antibiotic might be used to help the leather making industry and to help some of it in the food industry. We haven't gone too much farther with that because writing patents and getting funding is difficult. But the most important thing was the excitement of the discovery and having students along. There were five students who were involved in the original discovery. And again, a lot of things in science, a lot of fun discoveries just come from simple observations. So that was very exciting.
Yeah, I can see where that would really amp up a student's interest in pursuing more research.
Yes, yes.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions maybe about the evolutionary thinking in our society and in Christianity in general, too. First of all, one statement that seems you talk about biology and evolution, and everybody thinks of the statement, nothing in biology makes sense except in the context of evolution. So I've asked your response to that. How important is creation, actually, in the study of biology?
Yeah, all of us have people who have been influential in our lives, and Dr. Kurt Wise, who's been trained at Harvard and has done a lot of writing and mentoring of creationists, influenced me a lot in that, because I remember going to a conference with him one time, and he said, basically, we need to change that statement by Dobzhansky, where he said, nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution. He said we should change that to nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of creation. Just totally turned that whole thought on its head. And I think the way we can be involved in changing that perception is not only just showing where evolution falls short, but actually giving alternative explanations for the same data. Mm. I think maybe where creationists have made mistakes is we've said, well, that data was generated by an evolutionist, and so we have to throw it out. Now, anything in science is suspect because science is an activity by fallible humans. But when we look at data, if a person gathered data, in most cases, that data is neutral. It's numbers and measurements. And so in creationism, some of us have taken the same data, let's say that Darwin has used and others, and we've reinterpreted it within a creation model. And we've actually found some exciting things in that way in the area of baryonology, where we've looked at this concept of speciation. And we found evidence that certain created kinds have diversified over time into the same. They're in the same kind group, but they've diversified into slightly different creatures. It's like cats. You know, maybe at the original creation there was a cat kind, but today we see a lot of different cat varieties. And so Darwin use that same evidence to support evolution, and we're taking that same evidence and saying, wait a minute, that supports creation. That supports the idea that God created kinds, but he allowed for these small changes to take place to show diversity, which is a beautiful thing in God's creation, and it makes a lot of sense. So I think we need to take that whole statement and basically turn it around and show where creation ideas are just as powerful or more powerful than evolution, and actually show how, again, not to say just to say where evolution is wrong, but to show that the same data that the evolutionists can be reinterpreted in a creation framework. And I think that's very powerful, because the scientists on the other side can say, wait a minute, they're looking at the same thing we're looking at, and they got another interpretation. And science should be open to multiple interpretations. And so I think it's exciting. I mean, you know, maybe we don't win the day up front, but I have to believe it has to make the evolutionists think. It has to make them think, oh wow, someone has reinterpreted our data. There's another explanation. I would hope that would sink in, and because Romans 1 says everyone knows there is a God, and maybe just by participating in that activity, we can make someone think, you know, a little more about, oh, maybe there is an alternate explanation, and maybe there is an intelligent design. Maybe there's a designer behind all this. So to me, that's very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying this is more like on an individual basis. I was going to ask, what prospects do you see for any changes in evolutionary thinking, or is that more likely just to be an individual hearts rather than broad scale?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. Evolutionary thinking is still a pretty good force in our society. But I can tell you this. when I was working with the creationists a few years ago, and I still go to lunch with them now and then, I went to lunch with them this last summer, which was a year or so ago after our debate here, and they were still very curious about creation. And one person at the lunch who was part of a panel of the debate was asked a question by one of our students during the debate night. And I think that student asked, well, where does morality come from? And he said, well, evolution has solved that problem. Well, at the lunch we had, he basically told me he's thought about that question ever since the day of the debate. He has not stopped thinking about it. I think what we have to realize is, even though evolution looks like a powerful force in public education, that the people who hold to it are people who might think a different way, or if we plant a seed, they might think a different way. I don't know if creationism will ever win the day, because the Bible talks about there's a power on this earth. There's a, you know, there's a principality who rules the airways, and you know, I don't know if we can ever overturn it. But I think you said something very important. We can think about those around us and possibly winning the day, and making people think, making individuals think about what they believe in, with important questions, or with just our loving stand about what we believe. I think it probably will, if things go a certain way toward creationism, I think it will be one heart at a time, one person at a time. And I think God calls us that way. That's how evangelism works, to work with our neighbors, to work with those around us. And so I don't know what will happen in the future and how influential creationism will be, but it's exciting to know that God made people to observe him in nature, to see him in nature. And we can think about that. How can I know that my neighbor sees God in nature, according to Romans 1. How can I now help them see Christ, that he is the creator?
Well, your excitement comes through in, whenever I've seen you speak, and also in the articles that I've had the privilege of editing and reading that you've written for Answers Magazine. And I appreciate your passion, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Yes, thank you.